Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Political scientists and all students of politics, welcome to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Lee Bell, and today we welcome Jonathan Hopkin, Associate Professor of Comparative Politics at the London School of Economics, to discuss his new book, Anti-System Politics, The Crisis of Market Liberalism in Rich Democracies, published by Oxford University Press, expected in March or the very start of April 2020. Welcome to the podcast, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me.
So many people understand the rise of Trump or the success of Brexit as the result of nativism or racism or hostility to migrants. But your book uses comparative case studies of the United States, the UK, Spain, Italy, Greece, to argue that the rise of the xenophobic right and the anti-capitalist left are part of the same global trend, anti-system politics. So I was wondering if you could walk us through the basic claims of the book, and then we'll get to the meat of the argument that you make in the various chapters.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So the way you summarized it right now is correct. So what I'm trying to argue here is that fundamentally this very kind of disruptive kind of politics we're seeing in Western democracies at the moment. So Trump, Brexit being good examples, but also things like the independence movement in Catalonia, the rise of the left in Greece and Spain and Portugal, very recent election of Sinn Féin in Ireland, or at least the success of Sinn Féin in Ireland in the recent elections, all of that is part of a broad global trend of reaction against the kind of politics that has dominated really since the 90s across the rich democracies. And that's a politics of acceptance of the sort of broad market liberal settlement, if you like. So globalization, open borders, limited government intervention in the economy, restraints on government spending, and so on, combined with a kind of lack of serious alternative thinking in the political system more broadly. So all the main political parties and candidates generally saying similar things, and nobody really challenging the consensus position. So what I'm arguing is that over time, this has led to increasing discontent in Western electorates, and that this has accelerated after the financial crisis of late 2000s, and has led to a variety of different forms of revolt, if you like, against this broad market liberal consensus.
So you lay out in the book two sort of separate moments. One is the abandonment of the post-war model of egalitarian capitalism beginning roughly in the 1970s, but also the global financial crisis of 2007-2008. Can you say a little bit more about this moment in the 70s and the shift that is made then towards more technocratic government? Something that leaves less room for the voters, and expand upon that. And then also, what happens in 2007, 2008, as you see it? How does the financial crisis then affect or infect politics, depending on your point of view?
Right. Well, to kind of take that backwards, for a second, I think there's frequently a tendency to see the financial crisis of the late 2000s as a kind of shock, a kind of unexpected implosion of the financial system that brought about a series of political consequences. And I very strongly argue in the book that, that the financial crisis does have consequences, and that the main reason why politics has been so volatile in the last decade is because of the harm and the pain and suffering caused by the financial crisis. But I place that within the context of a longer-term shift, starting roughly in the late 1970s, away from attempts, what I call in the book democratic capitalism, attempts to use democratic politics to shape, constrain, adapt the market system, the capitalist system, to social needs. And, you know, this is a kind of a well-known story, what happens with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in the early 70s, the increasing inability of governments to protect themselves against the volatility of financial flows. And then this kind of political push led by Reagan in the US, Thatcher in the UK, towards more pro-market types of policies, rolling back the role of government in the economy, and policies which became increasingly spread across the whole of the Western democracies in a variety of ways. But there's a general trend towards more market liberal positions, even in the sort of advanced welfare states of continental and Northern Europe. This kind of weakens the foundations of democracy, because political parties, elected politicians, kind of give up on trying to control the economy in ways which would allow them to deliver on the kind of promises politicians tend to make. We're going to raise living standards. We're going to look after people. We're going to offer social services. We're going to protect you if you lose your job. We're going to allow you to improve your lives, to educate your children, and so on. Politicians are increasingly unable to really guarantee any kind of positive changes, and they're increasingly telling people, well, you know, it's a marketplace out there. You have to survive in an increasingly competitive global environment. We can maybe help you do that, but ultimately you're on your own. And this kind of, as well as creating insecurity amongst a lot of people in society, it also detaches citizens, voters, from the people who represent them. So the connection between voters and political parties is weaker and weaker. And people, when they vote in elections, are less and less confident that they're really voting for somebody to do things for them, to look after them, to protect them from, you know, the volatility and uncertainty of a market system. So, you know, this is already happening in 2008. We're already seeing an increasing tendency of people to not vote at all across Western democracies, declines in membership of political parties, and even amongst people who do vote, they're less and less likely to vote for the same party consistently. They're more and more likely to change their vote from one election to the next, and even begin to vote for sort of outsider parties. And of course, after the financial crisis, with the severe hit that people suffer in most Western countries, then the likelihood of people rejecting the established political elite and seeking solutions elsewhere increases very rapidly.
You argue that anti-systems politics arise from the failings of our political institutions to represent these popular demands, but you don't believe populism explains our recent politics in Europe, the UK, and the US. Would you explain for the listeners your preference for anti-system as opposed to populist, since that term is out there and over and over and over again?
Yeah, so I think populism is a difficult concept to use to talk about these kind of things for a number of reasons. First of all, because the way in which populism has entered the public sphere in political debates, in the media, it is used, generally speaking, to describe politicians like Trump. or right-wing politicians, especially right-wing anti-immigrant or xenophobic politicians in Europe, such as Salvini in France or Salvini in Italy and Le Pen in France. And of course, populism, as many Americans are well aware, has a much more varied tradition. There have long been populist movements on the left as well as on the right. So because a big part of the story I'm trying to tell is how anti-system politics is not necessarily solely right-wing, I wanted to avoid creating confusion by using the term populism, which many people tend to associate with kind of quite authoritarian kind of rhetoric, and especially this kind of xenophobic, anti-globalization, anti-foreigner kind of sentiment. There is another reason, though, which is that as you know, political theorists and scholars in political science are well aware, populism is quite a contradictory and an ambiguous term. There are many different meanings that have been developed in political science to of the word populism. And I just wanted to get out of that debate. I didn't want to turn the book into a discussion of the concept of populism. And I think the concept of anti-system politics captures nicely what I'm really interested in talking about, which is those political movements which reject the political establishment, if you like, by which I mean the political parties that have dominated democratic politics in Western countries, usually for many decades. So if we look at American politics, obviously Democrats and Republicans have been the dominant forces in American politics for at least a century. And in most European countries, very often the same political parties that have been governing in the recent period are political parties that were governing half a century or longer ago. So the Conservatives and the Labour Party in Britain, Christian Democrats or the Social Democrats in Germany, and so on. So anti-system politics, I thought, captured the various ways in which political movements can emerge to contest that political establishment and seek to break the kind of monopoly, the oligopoly, if you like, or cartel of these establishment politics. So using the word populism, I thought, would have kind of introduced an unnecessary layer of complexity and confusion to that.
I think when some people talk about populism, they are thinking about cultural reasons for the arise of a leader who emphasizes the fact that the people are not being appropriately cared for, that we're bailing out a bank, we're opposing austerity on citizens. You are, throughout the book, are very careful about separating out culture from economics. If I understand you correctly, you would look at these observers of politics who believe that cultural factors are what explain the rise of leaders from the left and the right who run as against the system. You say that it's superficially plausible, but the economics provides a much more powerful argument. So can you walk us through how it is that you think about xenophobia, how you think about the economics, how you weigh those, and why you tend towards understanding economics as the variable that we should be looking at?
Yeah, well, this is, I think, the crux of the debate that we're having at the moment about why is it that you get a Trump? Why is it that Britain voted to leave the European Union? And why is it that you get politicians following similar kind of hardline and especially anti-foreigner rhetoric in many other countries? Obviously, if you only focus on those right-wing cases, it's very easy to draw the conclusion that it's all about culture and it's about immigration and cultural diversity and identity politics. So if you only select right-wing populism, if you like, as the thing you're trying to explain, then a cultural argument is indeed very, very compelling, because it's true that the electoral survey data we have suggests that indeed voters who vote for politicians like Trump or Salvini or or who voted for Brexit in the UK do also tend to register high scores and anti-migrant sentiment and other sort of right-wing sociocultural positions, attitudes. But the problem is that if you cast your gaze a little bit further afield and start to look at what's been going on, for instance, in Southern Europe, in countries like Greece or Spain or Portugal, and even Italy to some extent, then what you can see is a much more varied picture of anti-system politics, which is not only on the xenophobic right, but also on the anti-capitalist left. And in some cases, almost exclusively on the anti-capitalist left. So if we look at Portugal, there is no representative in the Portuguese parliament and has been none adopting these kind of far-right positions. In Spain, a far-right party has emerged recently, but again, took a long time to emerge and is not as dominant a force as it is in some other countries. And in Greece, too, the far-right was definitely less important than the anti-capitalist, anti-austerity left. So if these kind of movements are emerging at more or less the same time as these far-right forces are also gaining in strength, then it seems really unlikely that a uniform cultural backlash against immigration and diversity could be driving both of these very, very different kinds of movements. And instead, what we see is that anti-system politics more generally, of both left and right, seems to prosper most in the countries that have suffered most from rising inequality, and in particular, the austerity and lack of growth in living standards that has followed the financial crisis. So for that quite simple logic, it seems to me that the cultural story is at best incomplete. And then there is research, which I cite in the book, more and more research coming out, which analyzes in a much more detailed, drilled down way the electoral dynamics behind various results that we've seen across the Western democracies. And you see that declines in living standards, cuts to welfare programs, economic decline more broadly are all very, very good predictors of the rise of anti-system politics. And as a result of that, it seems to me a little bit misleading to suggest that immigration might have sparked off this kind of reaction.
I understand wanting to distinguish the left and the right and also trying to be comprehensive. And I think actually one of the book's strengths is that this is not a case study of one place and then a few others that are superficial or sidelines or straw men. It really is a very nicely done distribution of places and parties so that you can make a more general argument. Maybe because I'm in the United States, I'm more focused on case from the right, well, actually, or from both Bernie Sanders, and you note in the book, are both coming from this same anti-systems approach. But, you know, as you note, anger, and you identify that there is an enormous amount of anger at the system and the technocrats that depended upon this capitalist neoliberal system to produce outcomes, that this anger can be in fact directed in different ways depending upon the narrative of how we talk about it and what the cause of it was. And so I think one of the things that I was really puzzled about was even if economics is the more powerful argument, how do you think about culture? How do you think about race? For example, how can we explain why poor working class Black and brown people in the United States would in fact stay with Hillary Clinton, who was the neoliberal, if their anger should have, their economics should have somehow trumped culture? So I'm not asking you to in any way take back the main claim. I'm just trying to figure out how culture nestles into the claims about economics.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And the answer is that although I'm adopting a very kind of economics-focused account here. And I definitely feel that the economics, and in particular, the kind of distributional effect of neoliberal reforms, which has, you know, led to greater inequality, vast concentration of income at the top of the distribution, especially in the United States, also in the UK, all of that has created a lot of economic distress for people at the bottom of the distribution, and also a lot of anger at so many people at the top doing so well. But of course, if you observe the economy collapsing, if you observe that you are not doing as well as you once did, or that your kids are not going to have the future that you had, you can be angry, but to be able to cast a vote to do something about it, you need to have some kind of idea about what has gone wrong and how it can be resolved. And of course, there are different ways of interpreting how the economy turned down and how we can pull it back up again. And of course, Trump has a story. Trump's story was that the system was rigged, that the international trading environment was rigged against American interests, that China and other countries were exploiting the U.S., and that also inside American society, certain groups were taking others for a ride. For instance, Wall Street was seen as being culpable in the decline of middle class America. But at the same time, Trump also was appealing to, you know, thinly veiled and often not at all veiled racist sentiment to do with the dependency of poorer people on the welfare system and so on. So that is one interpretation of what went wrong with the American economy, which can appeal to certain types of voters. But of course, there are other interpretations. Bernie Sanders' interpretation in some ways is really quite similar to Trump's. He also rails against Wall Street. He also contests the way globalization has affected American workers. But of course, his remedies do not involve, or at least I think most people would agree they do not involve any kind of racist sentiment, that they're instead about reorganizing American capitalism so that it's more redistributive, that it adopts some of the kind of social welfare institutions that are common in Europe and so on and so on. So even if you share the diagnosis that the economy's gotten bad and that it has affected you badly and that it's been bad for society, you can have very, very different ways of framing the solution. Now, why do some people go for the Trump version and some people go for the Sanders version? And of course, if in relation to your question, the reason why some left-leaning American voters still voted for Hillary Clinton, despite her centrist credentials in 2016, was because the alternative was Donald Trump, not Bernie Sanders in the actual presidential election. This time around, there may be a different set of choices, but undoubtedly, Sanders' rise is responding to the same kind of disquiet that brought us Trump, but of course, proposing very different kinds of solutions. Now, it's not random that a voter would go for the Sanders versus the Trump solution, because, you know, voters have attitudes, ideologies, policy preferences, which are more likely to fit with a Sanders story compared to a Trump story. And in particular, you can kind of see this through the prism of demographics. So older and less educated voters, especially in rural or semi-rural areas, are more likely to go for a right-wing anti-system response, whereas younger, more urban voters, especially non-white voters, are probably more likely to go for the left-wing variant. And we see this same kind of pattern playing out in Europe too. In the UK, it's much the same. Brexit was supported especially by older voters, by voters without a university education, without college degrees, and especially by voters who did not live in the major cities, whereas the kind of equivalent to Sanders in the UK, which is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, disproportionately won support amongst younger voters, especially voters with college degrees, living in the big cities. So that's my kind of long, you know, long of the short of it, why it is that you can get different forms of anti-system politics. And this model more or less predicts quite a lot of what's going on across a wide range of Western countries.
I think this is a good time to talk a little bit about how you wrote the book, the type of evidence, the kind of research that you do. So would you say a little bit about the work that you did before anti-system politics, and also the type of data that is used to reach the conclusions that the book does?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this book actually for me has been a great opportunity to bring together two broad threads in my research career that at times have kind of moved in parallel, but in this book I've been able to bring them together. And one has been political parties and the way they organize and the way they connect with voters. And in particular, I've been very interested in whether or not parties are able to be representative, whether they're able to actually mobilize broad constituencies around collective goods, or whether instead they are increasingly narrowly based organizations which depend heavily on vested interests and sometimes wealthy interests and are less able to actually build broad collective interests and implement policies in defense of them. So that's been one strand, but in most of the recent period, I've been kind of more interested in the political economy of inequality and why it is that some countries have higher inequality than others, and why some countries have been more exposed to the kind of inequality and insecurity generated by market liberal arrangements, and obviously in particular after the financial crisis. So this book allowed me to bring these two strands of research together by asking how we could understand changes in party politics through the prism of what's been happening to the economy and what's been happening to the distribution of income and wealth, and how the failings of the mainstream or establishment political parties in Western countries have prevented them really responding to social demands, demands for greater security, greater equality, greater economic certainty, if you like, and how that has created the space, the opportunity for new political forces to you know, win votes at their expense and carve out a niche of their own around sort of alternative ideas about how our democracies should be run. I mean, in terms of the methods and data, it's mainly a case study oriented book. So I have a chapter which brings together some basic statistical analysis of patterns of inequality, the extent to which countries were affected by the global financial crisis, and the way that affected different sectors of society in different ways. And also, obviously, I've had to kind of look around and attempt to observe and measure the extent and nature of anti-system politics across different countries. So that's involved looking at vote shares for different types of anti-system parties, looking at electoral volatility, the extent to which voters are likely to change their minds from one election to the next or reject mainstream political parties. And that analysis forms the basis for the selection of case studies, which are selected on the basis of trying to figure out why anti-system politics takes different forms in different places. So the UK and the US were nice cases where we saw both the emergence of a kind of economic nationalist or even xenophobic right, but at the same time, the resurgence of the socialist left. But in Europe, we have a different collection of cases which allows us to refine our thinking a little bit about what kinds of anti-system politics emerge out of which kinds of social, political, economic contexts. So in Northern Europe, we have relatively weaker anti-system politics. The mainstream parties have held on a little bit better, and to the extent there is anti-system politics in those countries, and we're talking about places like Germany, Sweden, the Netherlands, and so on. It tends to be the anti-system right, the xenophobic right, that does better than the anti-capitalist left. In Southern Europe, it's the other way around. So in Southern Europe, the anti-system right has been weaker, with the exception of Italy. But even in Italy, there's been a very strong anti-system left. And I try to explain that difference in terms of the way in which the Eurozone crisis, which is, of course, the kind of microcosm of the global financial crisis within the Eurozone, divided countries in terms of their creditor or debtor status. So in creditor countries, I found that, in other words, in countries which were running export surpluses and were able to lend money to other countries rather than be borrowers, in those countries, the anti-system right did better than the anti-system left. And in the debtor countries, countries like Italy, Spain, Greece, which had big external liabilities, the anti-capitalist left did better. And so by talking through those cases, I was able to explain why the different position of these countries in this kind of creditor-debtor dimension provided different opportunities to different types of anti-system movements.
Clearly, you believe that neoliberalism offers no solutions, but I'm wondering, as I read the book, I think I know what you want, but I guess I'd rather ask you, since I have you here, what do you want? Obviously, neoliberalism won't do it and has failed, and it's been a long time that we can chart that. So now what?
Yeah, well, that's probably for the sequel. In the conclusion to the book, I do try to draw out a little bit the implications of what I'm arguing. On the crudest, most basic level, I think one of the only way to really solve the problem of anti-system politics is to reestablish something which looks a little bit like the democratic capitalism of the period before the 1980s, if you like. This may seem hopelessly naive and backward-looking, and to an extent it is, because it is very difficult to get the toothpaste back into the tube once we've created a world economy where you cannot control capital flows very easily. It becomes very hard to actually run economies the way they were run in Western countries in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But that doesn't mean that we should give up on the idea of trying to control capitalism a little bit more strongly in order to protect people from the downsides of a capitalist system. In some of these measures can relatively easily be implemented even in the current world economic environment, that is to simply attempt to make taxation and social spending more equitable and more redistributive. And all of that can be done with, you know, as long as there's sufficient political will and sufficient political support, there's no good technical reason why government should not be able to do some of those things. I think much more fundamentally, though, what we need to do, and I don't really have the answer to this myself, but I think I have the right question, which is we need to try and think about how we can protect society from the what you could call the blackmail power of global capitalism. Countries, and we saw very, very clearly in the financial crisis that when global financial markets lose confidence in a country. And the usual reason for that is because that country is running some kind of deficit, either a government deficit or a current account deficit, usually both, then governments have very little power to resist this threat of investors to pull their money out. And in those circumstances, it's impossible to really look after your electorate. It's impossible to generate the resources to be able to protect people from economic downturns and attempt to get economies moving again. The Eurozone crisis, which forms a chunk of my analysis in this book, is a very good demonstration of how even when you have the right institutional resources to be able to do something about that, if you have the wrong politics, you can still fail. So the Eurozone crisis was, the euro is still there. So in a way, it was the response to the Eurozone crisis was a success, at least in that respect. But in terms of the terrible economic suffering that resulted in countries like Greece, Spain, Portugal, and still in Italy, and the relatively underwhelming economic performance even of the more successful countries in Northern Europe, this suggests, a political failure. And it's a political failure that resulted from the inability of mainstream political parties to actually be more bold and use the tools available to the Eurozone decision makers to protect societies from this capitalist blackmail power, if you like, and act to promote a rapid economic recovery, which would protect the weaker people in society from long-term unemployment, declining living standards. So my reading of the economics literature and following economics debates over the last decade or so, I don't think the problem is that we haven't figured out how to do those things. I think the problem really is that we haven't been able to constitute a strong enough political coalition to achieve them. The reason that hasn't happened is because the mainstream political parties of both left and right in our democracies have shown a real lack of courage, a lack of intellectual openness, and a lack of will to actually do those things. The rise of anti-system parties, in many ways, it's very unwelcome. I'm very uncomfortable with the success of kind of right-wing xenophobic economic protectionist political movements. But it is also true that the alternative, kind of more conservative, orthodox approach, which we've seen not only in conservative mainstream parties, but also in socialist and social democratic mainstream parties in Europe, is not going to provide an answer either. And so this voter revolt, this anti-system revolt, at the very least, has forced mainstream political parties to start thinking a little bit more about how we can protect society from the volatility of a capitalist economy. And we're seeing this. We're seeing it not necessarily very successfully so far, but the strong showing of Sanders in the current primary campaign, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn could get elected to leader of the Labour Party, although he failed to win an election, these are early signs that things can change. And we've also seen in countries like Spain and Portugal similar movements towards trying to curb capitalism in the public interest.
Throughout the book, you draw parallels between 1930, 2006. 1930s had the war. Is it possible to recalibrate without catastrophe? I think you're suggesting what would need to happen, but did much of that happen because of catastrophe? How would the system heal itself apart from a candidate like Bernie Sanders, for example, possibly coming out and winning? And then we would have two anti-systems politics candidates in the same election.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful, obviously, that we can manage to get out of this without a war. And I think part of the reason why I'm reasonably confident that it's not going to be a repeat of the 1930s is that however bad things have been for working people over the last decade or so, they're certainly nowhere near as bad as they were in the 1930s. So obviously, Western democracies are much richer countries. We all, to a greater or lesser extent, have welfare systems that protect most people from the worst sides of economic downturns. And also, even though I sometimes worry that we're losing sight of the lessons of the mid-20th century, but I think there's still enough awareness of the fact that any kind of militaristic response to economic downturns could potentially lead to catastrophe. So I think for all those reasons, I don't think it's going to lead us down that terrible path. But at the same time, it is certainly true that the war did concentrate minds in a number of ways and allow Western countries to come out of the war and adopt some of the right institutions to create a capitalism which was inclusive and worked for most people. And my fear is that in the absence of those emergency conditions, it becomes very hard to actually take difficult decisions and challenge entrenched interests. Let's remember that in the immediate post-war period, even in countries like the United States or in Britain, which have never been particularly socialist-oriented countries, top rates of tax reached over 90% for some of the highest earners. You can imagine the furore if any attempt was made to revive that now. But in the 1940s and 50s, it was accepted because in a situation of national emergency, elites realized that they had to do whatever was necessary to hold society together and protect countries from military threat. And even after the war, the presence of the Soviet Union, which of course was not recognized as being an economic failure until much later, also helped concentrate minds, gave people in government and people in the wealthy classes an awareness of the fact that if things went wrong, it could all get very bad for them. We don't really have that at the moment, but I think the rise of Sanders, the rise of Corbyn and left movements across Europe is hinting at a need, if you like, for the wealthy elite to share the proceeds of economic growth more equitably. But at the moment, I get the feeling that things are not bad enough for to convince them that they should do that now or to any really significant degree. And I think this is the real risk in the medium term for our democracies, is that things can get bad, but they're nowhere near bad enough to persuade the people who have the ability to block change to actually embrace it and start to move back to a form of capitalism which is more consistent with a cohesive society.
And that sounds right. And also, if you think about catastrophe, you know, the possible existential crisis that we're facing is climate change. And it's unclear how anti-system politics from the right or the left could create a narrative of mixing, addressing climate change in a radical way and anti-systems, unless they were to say this is what capitalism brought you, and here's how a revival of social democracy would both solve the problems of vast inequality and the future catastrophe that might be coming.
Yeah, I think if I were to rewrite the book now, I would have probably paid a lot more attention to climate change and the ways in which climate change could be part of a story of how we recalibrate capitalism, if you like, to make it more consistent with social needs. There's no greater social need, really, than the need to have an environment that's habitable. And it's also clear that the way capitalism is working at the moment is totally inconsistent with that need. The problem is that unlike a war, climate change is a relatively slow process. It's going way faster than is comfortable, but it's still not bad enough to make us think we got to stop this and we got to stop it now. We're like Saint Augustine, you know, make us virtuous, but not yet. But certainly, I think there is the potential for climate change, and I think the broadly shared these days recognition outside the American right, perhaps, that something needs to be done, creates an opportunity for politics which is not only more environmentally sustainable, but also more socially equitable. Because if for nothing else, climate change is going to require a lot of coordination by government. The even if it's something as minimalistic as introducing patterns of taxation, which try to disincentivize environmentally damaging behaviors. But more likely, it's probably going to involve some kind of major infrastructure effort, which probably can only be done if government takes the lead. And of course, the reason why neoliberalism is peculiarly unsuited to this is because it strips government of the power to take control of the economy, to redirect the resources of the economy towards social ends rather than letting them be allocated according to market forces. So in that sense, climate change is not true for the left.
If we were to see two anti-system politics candidates, Sanders and Trump, face off, is your intuition, obviously this is beyond the research of the book, what happens in that case? Is it does the anti-system piece neutralized or is it heightened? What would be the response from the public if both candidates are claiming to run against the system?
That's a really good question. And I'm not foolish enough to make predictions. I mean, it would certainly be an extremely unusual election, by American standards at any rate. But the idea of a political context in which, on the one hand, you have a kind of very conservative right set up against a kind of quite radical left, seems much more unusual now than it might have done a few decades ago. After all, you know, it was quite common in Europe for a very long time to have elections in which the gap in ideological terms between the major political parties was much, much greater than it became in more recent times. So if you think of take an example, in 1948 in Italy, an election pitted the Christian Democratic Party, which was very conservative in social cultural terms, against the Italian Communist Party. Those were the two main parties in Italian politics. And similarly, in many other elections. In 1983 in Britain, we had Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party, sort of very neoliberal, right-leaning party, set against the Labour Party of Michael Foot, which was way, way, way to the left. So actually, the idea that elections could be a real choice between two radically different visions of society, this is nothing new in democracy. And in fact, in some ways, it may be necessary if we want to think about how to improve things and reform our societies for the better. I think pretending that there are no fundamental philosophical disagreements or pretending that different social groups don't have diametrically opposed interests is not going to help. We need to have these debates to understand how we can govern our societies better.
So tell me, what's your next project?
Well, I mean, I've been trying to think about what I'm working on a number of different papers at the moment, but what I'm really interested in doing is delving a bit more deeply into the kind of cultural foundations of different economic models, if you like. So, and by cultural foundations, I'm talking about the role of political ideologies, but also of organized religion in shaping the way capitalism works in different places. So I've long had a keen interest in Southern European politics. At the same time, I'm British. I work in Britain, spend a lot of time in the United States as well. And so I'm really interested in this contrast between a kind of more Anglo-Saxon, individualistic view of the world, which has shaped the political economies of Britain and the United States to a considerable extent, contrasted with the kind of more, if you like, more collectivist vision of society that is more common in Southern Europe, a collectivism which takes very different forms. On the one hand, a kind of more conservative Catholic version, and on the other, a more socialist or even communist version, which have led to market economies developing in Southern Europe to be very different types of arrangements to what we're used to in the English speaking world. And I've always been very curious to sort of try and see how much the kind of deep cultural roots of these societies could help explain some of these differences in how the economy is organized.
Well, we'll look forward to that book, having another conversation. For now, I will say to everyone that this is a remarkably clear and well-written book. It is easy to work through any of the concepts that you're not familiar with. I say as a political theorist going through the charts, very easy. This is an important book. It's timely. As you're reading it, I think it would be very, very hard if you are in rich democracy not to see elements of your own politics, new politics, politics of the past. I recommend it to everyone. This is a forthcoming book, Anti-System Politics, The Crisis of Market Liberalism in Rich Democracies. It's from Oxford University Press. You can pre-order it now on the Oxford University Press website, or pre-order it from your online providers, such as Amazon, as you wish. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jonathan, and for sharing this terrific new project with us.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.